So, yeah, I am. I'm a human being. I'm an atheist. I can see that I'm predisposed to addictive behaviour. From my earliest memories, having low self-esteem and a big ego. I think I said I'm a male, identify as a male. A lot of this stuff, I mention this because there's some people in this meeting, actually, and pardon me if I jump around on here because I've actually really intentionally tried to not think about what I wanted to share about, or, you know, I've got some sort of kind of notes and stuff like that because I think sometimes I find it really difficult to sort of put a bit of chronology to it. But there's some people in this meeting that I've met probably 18 months ago who have shaped the way that I look at my life in the 12-step fellowship, and I really, really appreciate that. You know, I'm not going to bother mentioning their names. They know who they are. And I don't only mean the way that I perceive how I'm able to actually live in this fellowship, but also people who have had probably experiences with, like, gender stuff, you know, with the pronoun thing and all that sort of stuff. And it's kind of been really good food for thought, you know. Instead of me sort of just sort of like meandering along, it's really sort of opened me up to just thinking about my life a little bit differently and the way that I want to sort of kind of live within the framework of this fellowship, you know. And I guess what's happened to me over the last 18 months doing secular meetings, and I'll just talk about that to start with because this is where I am and that's how I got here, is that, number one, I noticed there was a lot of big fishes in small ponds, and it kind of wasn't really attractive to me, you know, because it's easy for me to talk underwater with a mouthful of marbles, you know. I can bore you to death for a couple of hours without taking a breath, you know, and it's kind of something that wasn't sort of sitting too well with me. And when I come to these secular meetings, I noticed that there were subtle differences in the way that people shared. There was an element of comfortability in people sharing about stuff that wasn't necessarily towing the line with NA speak, you know, and it started to sort of kind of resonate to me and just sort of kind of made sense to me, and it gave me a new sense of purpose, because I've got to be honest, I've been clean for 23 years and 5 months, and for probably 20 odd years of those, at that time in the NA, I allowed NA to speak for me, and I parroted a lot of the literature, even though I didn't connect with it. And I would hear Carlos ID and say he's an atheist, you know, and I would think about that, and it's like, well, there's a lot of stuff that I've gone through in all the literature and all the writing, all the stuff that I've done, and there were just big chunks of it that I just didn't connect to. And it wasn't even so much trying, but it's just that I didn't connect to it, you know, and I sort of kind of come to the, I guess, the understanding that I am an atheist, you know. I don't believe in God. Religion makes me feel uncomfortable. And how the fuck do I actually continue to exist in the NA fellowship when I hear a lot in mainstream meetings, people talk about that three-letter word, which has a meaning, and everyone fucking knows what it means. You know, people can deny it, but it does, and it happens. And I started to kind of pick fault with it. I started to not listen to the message in mainstream meetings. And so I was getting nothing from it, you know. And then, fortunately, by a set of circumstances, I was browsing the Australian NA meetings list, and I saw this little meeting in Frankston in Victoria, which said atheist, agnostic, and free thinkers. And I got onto this meeting, and there was young Elvis and Ronnie and Anthony expunging the virtues of this secular meeting. And I kind of felt at home straight away, you know. It was a really nice experience, and it took a bit of time because I got to be honest, I was a bit of me against them, you know, coming to the understanding about being an atheist against the God botherers and all that sort of stuff. And then I realized in meetings that I didn't need to justify why I was, but just how I lived my life as an atheist in the fellowship, you know. And so here I am, you know. Yeah, what is it now? It's fucking October 2021, and I have no idea what day it is. I have no idea what time it is. You know, I just know that I'm here. I'm really grateful that I'm here. So, in saying all that, my earliest memories were as I said before, I grew up in a household that was an emotional desert to parents who were children of parents who came from a world war. So I think it was an unrealistic expectation that these people were going to have any concept of, you know, dealing with their emotions and having any tools to navigate their way through it. So I was brought up in that environment, you know, and it wasn't the world's worst environment. My father was quite, he was a big figure, Serbian man, very angry all the time. So I lived in fear, but it was essentially, it was that typical Australian household, you know, sort of, you know, three kids and whatnot. But I just remember living, my earliest memories are that I lived in fantasy. I did not know how to interact with the world. I felt different from my earliest memories, and I just did, and I lived in fantasy, and I kind of never really sort of matured through that for a long, long period of time. And just still to this day, I still can be that person. I can still go back there, you know. And so just not having those tools to sort of to deal with stuff and to navigate my way through it, it's just made it incredibly difficult to connect with the world, you know. And I could talk about like going through school and high school and all that sort of stuff, but you know, truly I'd rather get to the nuts and bolts of, you know, of what happened to me when I started to use and then and post using and stuff like that. And so, you know, just to go through that whole process and to become a teenager and start working and still having no identity, still having no clue on who I was, and not connecting with my feelings and my emotions, other than I knew I was angry, you know, I was scared, and a few other things. But it was a real sterile sort of kind of life that I felt like I was living. I was just a human being, you know. I was just existing without really connecting to anything. And the irony was that of that is that I'm a really emotional dude. I'm really fucking sensitive, you know. For some reason, I'm the only one of my entire family, about my mum and dad's side, who is creative, you know. I got into the music stuff. I was in the music game for 12 years, and I went down that path. So when I finished sort of kind of doing that thing at home, and then I got the fuck out of Dodge and moved into the city, into the that inner city music scene and stuff, I found a bunch of hombres that were fucking speaking my language, you know. And that language wasn't about asking how you felt, but it was actually just about taking drugs and fucking, you know, the Wild West, I guess. And it was really, really attractive. I didn't care that if I was going to live or die. There was no consideration to the future. And to be quite honest, and I got to say that everyone who was in that game were pretty much fucked up on drugs anyway, you know. And it was only in hindsight that later on, you know, like a decade later, I used to wonder what happened to all these people. And then when I fucking got clean, I realised they either died or they got clean, you know what I mean? And so I went through that whole process of, you know, the music thing. And to be quite fair, it was just another environment. It was just another opportunity for me to wear a hat, to act as if, just to fit into part of something, you know. And whilst I actually did, I was creative and I am creative and I was part of that, there was still a big part of me that didn't really connect to people and didn't really connect to anything that I was doing. And so the drugs were fantastic, you know, and the whole, you know, smoking pot and drinking alcohol and snorting speed and then jacking speed up and then, you know, fucking peyote and all that sort of jazz, that all came along. But there was a point in my life where there's a bunch of people who were kind of fucking dark characters, and they're from Elvis's neck of the woods down in Victoria. The musos down there are a lot fucking heavier than the Sydney dudes, and I got involved with them. I was playing in a band that had some musicians that came from Victoria, from Melbourne, Victoria, and I got introduced to the needle, like full tilt, you know, on the gear. And I still remember the first time I shot up heroin, and I'm not going to neg rave too much, in case it puts people off the air, but I fucking vomited everywhere. And I was on the footstep of this guy. This guy was quite well known in the industry, in his apartment or his house in the city. And I remember vomiting everywhere, but going back for more. I just, something happened to me and it just shifted and I just felt part of something. But what it did for me, it took away that care factor, you know. And then what it did is that, like, you know, we would, that bunch of people would get together and we would do this stuff, and then it became like a more constant thing. And then it became the point where, you know, it was a daily thing and then a few times a day, and then the behaviours, you know, all the illegal stuff and all the thieving and all the fucking dishonesty, you know, and dragged me down to a level where it took me before I got clean. But I truly, I used to listen to people in meetings and people in early recovery who did these fucking new age rehabs and shit like that, who are really connected to their feelings. And I've got to be honest, it took me fucking 7 years to fucking have a feeling, you know. It took me 7 years to write about my dad. So I wouldn't know a feeling if I fell over it for a long, long time when I was clean, you know. And people would share about that they would have these conscious sort of kind of memories or these conscious thoughts about, you know, why they were using and when they were using and stuff like that. And I don't know. I don't know whether I'm just a stupid man or what the fuck's going on with me, but I just loved being stoned. I loved what it did to me. I loved the fact that it just took away the care factor. I loved the fact that it put me into a state where I would read a paragraph in a paper 20 times before I woke up because I dropped my cigarette and I was burning a hole in my leg or the lounge. You know what I mean? It was great, you know? And to the point where the end game was about not waking up from it, you know? So where it was when it started, to feel part of that whole scene, the group of people, to where it took me was just two different worlds, you know? And, you know, the behaviours that went along with it and the isolation, you know, I just, in reflection and in writing about stuff and in step work, I could kind of pinpoint in certain parts of my using where people would start to drop off, because they would either, as I said, they'd either die or they'd get clean. But there was also a bunch of people who were, I guess they weren't really, sort of couldn't really identify or weren't, wouldn't identify as a true addict. You know, they were able to stop and just move on and move away from it and stuff. And some of us that kept going through this, it just became a little bit real for some people, you know. And from being that kid when I was growing up who was fucking scared of everything, and I remember consciously saying when I started to go out that I would never, ever touch drugs, to be the worst one out of the lot. And I don't mean I fucking used to mix up in a walk and, you know, I was a fucking bank robber and all that sort of shit. I just mean I was the last man standing and I thought I'd never do this, and I fucking did, and I just kept going. You know? And so out of all the circle of people that I knew that I played in bands with and all that sort of stuff, started to die, you know. A couple of them got clean, which I bumped into later. And then I was just left holding the can, man. My best mate, Stuart, he was in a really successful band. He killed himself. He wrote a letter and he blamed everyone. I remember his mother ringing me up and fucking just wailing on me, and I'm just like, well, whatever the fuck, and just had another shot, you know. I didn't give a shit. By that stage, I was just a cold, dead fish. And I continued to use for a couple more years, you know. And it got to the point for me where I was like bumper shooting cigarette butts on bus shelters, you know, as I was like 31, you know. So, again, I don't think I was a stupid man, but it took me to places where I just didn't think I would go. And I guess the last place for me that I seriously contemplated was about selling my ass, you know. I was obviously a lot younger, a lot prettier. But, yeah, I contemplated it. And then, I don't know, it's just I made a call one day to I was homeless. I remember I was homeless. I was in this park in the inner city, and I had a bag of clothes. I just ripped off my dealer and I hocked one of his guitars and I got a $50 shot. And I rang an ex of mine who had just been, for whatever reason, been thinking about me and had been resourcing detoxes. And I happened to be 50 metres away from this detox. So I don't know what that means. I don't know. By that stage, I'd been doing the whole methadone thing as well. I'd done that three times, you know, and had to get back on the gear just to get off the dome, and, and all that sort of shit. So at this stage, when I rang my ex, I was right in the middle of a really healthy heroin and methadone habit. And I was just seriously on the bones of my ass. And to show me how powerful the concept of this being a disease, which was the language that I understood for a long time in Narcotics Anonymous, I walked over to that detox. They let me in. I stayed there for 11 days. I was that fucking brain dead that I was in a room by myself at the front of this detox, and there was two beds in this room, and I slept in this one bed, and they didn't have doorknobs because they didn't want people to lock themselves in or close themselves in. But there was a fucking hall light was left on. And where I was lying was right in my eye line. And of course I couldn't sleep because I was detoxing off the fucking gear and dough. Do you think I moved beds to around the corner? I just kept rolling from side to side and putting my arm over my head. You know what I mean? Like, I seriously think about that a lot. I don't know why, but I just think about that a lot. I was just, I was fucked. So for 11 days, what felt like exposed nerve endings was the most horrible experience in my life to this day that's personally happened to me in regards to the way I felt and the things that I would try and do just to get some comfortability. And I fucking did it, 11 days. Now, I reckon one or two people here would know the answer to this question. What did I do on day 12 when I got out? I fucking used heroin. Of course I used heroin, you know. And it just continued. It continued. And I've got to be honest, there's parts of my story which are really, really dusty. I don't know if I've sort of damaged parts of my brain, but there's some parts that are just missing. But I know I ended up in a DOS house in Darlinghurst. Silly me took the third floor where you could smoke, not really understanding or realizing that all the fuckers up there had emphysema, so you couldn't sleep anyway, you know, 31 years of age. But remembering something from this detox experience was that I went to a meeting. This meeting was on a Thursday night in King's Cross, which is kind of a well-known suburb in Sydney for all the villains and criminals and the night workers and stuff. And I went to this meeting. And there were people in this meeting who had leather jackets with padded shoulders. The blokes had ponytails and like bald spots. And I'm just sitting in this fucking meeting thinking that I was better than, whilst hanging out from fucking smack and done, because I think I was clean for I don't know how long. Wouldn't have been a day. And I went to this meeting and I was just sweating bullets, looking at all these people, thinking that I was better than them, you know. And it was a fucking bizarre experience. And that was the first time I'd ever been exposed to the rituals of Narcotics Anonymous meetings, where they would hand the book around and read, whether it was the big book or whatever it was, but they would hand it around and people kind of knew to read a paragraph, you know, and I'm just sweating bullets because this book's getting fucking closer to me and I didn't know what to, you know, I didn't know what to do. But I made it through. I don't even know whether I spoke to anyone. I don't know. I don't have those memories where people came up and fucking asked me how I was and gave me phone numbers. I don't have those memories. But I guess I was, the seed was planted to a degree, you know. And then I made my way to a meeting on a Monday at lunchtime where there was a bunch of people in a rehab. And I didn't stay clean, but of course I didn't stay clean. How could I? But I made my way to this rehab and to this meeting on a Monday in Darlinghurst again. And there's a bunch of people from a rehab, the We Have Ourselves rehab, which is now located, it was in Pitt Street, Redfern, now it's in Roselle. And I just spoke to these people and like a fucking lost puppy, I walked back to this rehab with them. Just cold, just walked back with them. You know, I was that fucked. I didn't even get the shit there where I was staying. I didn't give a fuck. I spoke to this guy, John R. He had what seemed a zillion years clean. He had really, really intense eyes. I remember he was intensely focused. He looked like he had hard eyes, but he was, and this is where I'll get a little bit emotional because I love, there's a couple of people who I really love in this rehab who are my friends still today, 25 years later. He sat me down and spoke to me and he let me in. And I stayed in this rehab for 6 months, earning the ire of a lot of the staff there because I used to neg rave a lot and I used to think that I knew everything and I knew nothing. And my experience in this rehab for the first time was, I think it gave me an opportunity to get the fuck out of society, and I think it gave society an opportunity to get away from me as well. It introduced me to the 12-step fellowship because they would do two meetings a day and one a day on the weekends. So I was made to do. Not made to do. There was no bars on the door. So they did in their program, they did 12 meetings a week, and that's what I was exposed to Narcotics Anonymous and to some people that I'm still friends with today, you know. And I got some good lessons. I was supported to make my bed and to wash my coffee cup. And the intention behind it was, it wasn't the elephants that were going to get me, but the white ants. You know, it's the small things. If I couldn't do the small things, I'm no chance of doing the big things. And some of these things are good takeaways for me, you know. And again, it's like that NA speak stuff, you know. Some of the stuff I still use today because it means something to me. It just reminds me, you know, it puts me back in a headspace that is a positive experience for me anyway. And so I did this, you know, and then I spent 4 months opening a halfway house for men out of this rehab, and that was a great experience, you know. But there was always in my mind that life and the other life. So there was this NA life, this being clean life, but there was also this other world that I was still thinking about, you know, and it had to do with music and had to do with, you know, that sort of crazy part of how I used to live and whatnot, and I yearned for it and I missed it. So I never, ever settled on the fact that I needed to take what I'd learned and what made sense to me into my world, you know what I mean? Just take that as part of the training ground into the playing field type of thing, you know? And I kind of went out into the world, started to work, did the meetings, did service, did all that stuff, you know, from the outside it looked like I was doing good, you know? And I remember one day or a couple of times I used to see this guy selling a big issue. It's a lot of these people, the homeless people, sell this magazine. To just get him back into the workforce and stuff. And I used to see this guy outside of this train station who I was in rehab with and I knew he was using, you know. And by that time I had sufficiently spent enough time away from treatment and by my own devices and had a girlfriend and, you know, I was living in this nice little apartment and shit down Piedmont where all the casinos are and whatnot. And I just started to see him on the bus ride to work and back all the time, you know. And shy of 18 months clean, I was about 16, nearly 17 months clean. I decided to take a little venture into the Piedmont Hotel, and there was a bar lady there, bar girl there, who was just gorgeous. And I thought it was a really good idea to sit down and order a schooner of beer, and just so I could, you know. And I went home, I had a shower, I convinced myself that I was okay. Within an hour, I'm up with that guy at selling the big issue, walking to his dealer's place, getting a shot of smack. And it was all over Red Rover. So all the shit that I'd gone through, all the detox horrors I'd went through and coming back and doing meetings and service and stuff just went out the door. Because for me, in retrospect, and I've since written about it, I wasn't capable of connecting with the principles that I'd learned in the stuff that I wrote about and the stuff that I was trying to live by, because I had, you know, I had some doubts. I had some misgivings about, you know, there was still stuff that I wasn't sure about that I hadn't really committed to. And so I used, you know, and that 4 months was kind of the most pathetic using that I'd ever done, because I don't know, and it's a good thing. I think, again, in hindsight, it was a good thing that I bashed myself up that much in that whole using history, that 14 years where I hooked in, that I was really, really fatigued, and I ended up not using more than I did use, you know. And on the 12th of April 1998, I didn't get credit from my dealer. I hung out all night and I walked to the same rehab. It was Easter. It was a public holiday. And I walked to that same rehab and I knocked on the door, and a guy who was working there that 2 years prior, he was still working there. He was now the program coordinator. And he too had a zillion years and had a real stern look at his eye. He told me to wait out the front and made me wait out there for 2 hours, the prick. And he came out and spoke to me. And I love this man. I love this man. He's got like 42 years clean now, you know. He made me go and get all my stuff. And he said, you've got to come back here with your eyes the same as what they are now. And I did. And I got my shit, got the guitars that I had still and a little black and white TV and a bag of clothes. And I fucking waddled back. And I got to say, as this son of a Serbian man from the western suburbs of Sydney who never shows their emotions, who doesn't ask for a favour and never shows their feelings, I fucking cried like a baby for the first week I was back in treatment. Lassie didn't come home. I cried like a baby. Tom Cruise drove through the thunder of Days of Thunder, drove through the smoke, and I cried like a baby. I used to fucking just break down, and some of the program coordinators go, oh, fuck, here he comes, you know. And I used to target this one guy, Martin, who ended up becoming my sponsor. The most gentlest of men I've ever met. Turned out to be the most ruthless of sponsors that I'd ever had. He would not let me go past the bold headline. We had to get to the nature of what we were talking about, you know. And I really appreciated that from him, that he was, it wasn't so much that he was hard as in he was aggressive, it was just the fact that he just was really good at what he did, you know. He really understood the concept of it, and which I believe I'm a terrible sponsor. I don't sponsor people. I'm really passive. But I really appreciated that man. And so those three men that I, circumstances, they were put in my life, you know, they're still today are my friends. I don't see them that much. I don't talk to them that much, but we are completely 100% comfortable with each other and can have conversations about anything still today, which is a wonderful thing. And they do mainstream NA, so I don't really talk. You know, they talk about higher powers and stuff like that. So there's part of it that I, you know, the reasons why I don't see them that much. But where am I up to? Yeah, I'm up to there. So the shift in me from that first week was that, and again, it's something I wrote about later in my step work, was it stopped being an intellectual Olympics and it became an emotional exercise in connecting with my heart. And I was able to understand that there was so much nonsense going on between these two things that came into here and was just putting, and it was just difficult to try and get to the journey, that longest journey to the heart, you know, and connect with it. And but something has shifted, and all through all those tears, I felt it. And I was able to breathe. I just felt like my using was done, you know. And I'm not saying I'll never use or never drink or never whatever again, but I just felt that I kind of was at a place where, you know, there was a door closing, you know. And so it was an opportunity for me to take with both hands, an opportunity to actually sort of start to do something positive in my life, you know. And like I said, because I had no concept of the whole atheist thing other than I just didn't believe in God, the journey for the next 20-odd years was about the literature and parroting that literature and reading it out and saying it and the serenity prayer, you know, God grant me the serenity, all that sort of shit, you know, just saying it, you know. And but there's a lot of good stuff that's happened in between. You know, there's a lot of good stuff, especially I always refer to the first three steps were the foundation that I still rely upon today when I talk about honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. And for me, and what Martin's sort of, I guess, supported me on was that I was able to use those three adjectives and sort of go anywhere with them, just go anywhere with them, you know. And I've been able to do that. And it's helped me in so many situations that I've experienced in my life. You know, I got married. I met someone when I was 2 years clean. We got pregnant, got married because I thought that's what I should got to do, you know, and did that and was with them for 13 years and had two children and became this sort of kind of solid citizen, you know. Stopped playing music, which I missed terribly. You know, I retired. But became the primary income earner and had a lot of responsibility. And so there was a big chunk of my life through that middle part of being in the fellowship that I guess, I don't say spirituality, I don't sort of use those words. I just emotionally, I sort of kind of forgot about myself for a big chunk of it because my focus with me and my partner were on our children and they became a big focus. And so there was a lot of, I guess, a lot of stuff that sort of kind of built up that wasn't sort of tended to and wasn't paid attention to, but just sort of drifting along and going through the motion with me and my now ex. She's in the fellowship as well. She's got 22 years up. But I stayed clean, you know, I stayed staunch and I still had that resonance with the fact that there wasn't two lives anymore. It was just, this was my life, you know, and this is how I wanted to live my life. And so, you know, stayed clean, went through all that. And I believe that Narcotics Anonymous has helped me be a good dad. You know, I wanted to be hands-on. I wanted to change their nappies. I wanted to talk to my now teenage daughters about depilatory products and periods and fucking boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever the fuck, whatever's going on for me. And I've learned a lot of that stuff by coming here and speaking to people who had some sort of knowledge on whatever the topic may be, who weren't trying to fucking teach me or coach me or educate me or parent me, but were just trying to support me on their own experiences, you know, and their own histories. And I really appreciated that. And especially in the secular community, I've got that a lot more than the mainstream. And so, you know, I got to the point where I'm separated 8 years ago. It took me 2 years to realize that I was single. It's taken me the next 6 years or so to really get to know myself. And I think there's some element of truth in the fact that it's not written anywhere. And I fucking hate when people make it truths that they're not truths, but you know, you shouldn't get in a relationship for the first, which is bullshit. It's not written anywhere. But for me, it was actually quite important to actually spend some time with myself to find some authenticity and what the fuck was going on up here and what was coming out here and then my actions, you know. And I did a fourth step in the ocean. I did a fifth step with a mate of mine who was like less than 6 months clean. He was the guy that I leaned on, that I trusted. They'd been in the program for 10 years but just was constitutionally incapable of staying off the drugs but was clean at the time. And I was quite comfortable sharing a four-step with him in the surf while we're fucking just body surfing. And it was a wonderful experience. And again, he was there just to listen. He wasn't there to try and educate me or parent me. He was just there to support me through the empathy and the understanding of a like-minded individual with similar interests. You know, so I've done three, four steps and fifth steps, and they were focusing on sorry, I'm jumping a bit, but the first one was about NA told me that I had to do it. You know, I got to that point. I done one, two, and three. I wrote about it to the best of my ability. What the fuck I wrote about, I don't know. I was crazy. You know, I was in the first 2 years of my life in the fellowship and I was just nuts. And the first four step was 32 A4 pages long. My poor sponsor at the time had to sit and listen to this. You know, these things, 32 of those fucking things. I don't know if that's small or large. I don't know. But it was tight writing. There was a lot of words on there, you know. I know now why he made me pay for all the coffees, you know, but it was probably the first opportunity I had to trust someone, because apart from all the issues that I brought to the table when I came here, the trust was the big one, you know, the anxiety in my belly that the clock hand was going backwards, but the trust was because I'm, you know, I'm one of those dudes that can tick a lot of those boxes as a narcissist and stuff, you know, and just an isolated by myself kind of guy that doesn't trust the world. It was a big leap to put it out there to share with someone stuff that I was going to the grave with. And because when I was writing about it, when I was answering these questions, I couldn't understand, and I still actually struggle with a lot of the literature, a lot of the speak on what the fuck has that got to do with me stop jacking up smack, you know? What has that got to do with me stop shooting heroin, you know? And but I did the best I could, you know? At the time, I did the best I could. And but it was, I guess the takeaway for me was that I was able to trust this dude, you know? And what it did is it instilled a little bit of empathy in me for my fellow addict, you know? And I was able to sponsor some people in early days. And this dear lad, Heath, he asked me to sponsor him. He was terrified of the fact that he was attracted to men, but it was such a good-looking guy. He was a musician, but all the girls loved him and struggled with it. And we spent hours talking about it. He killed himself because he couldn't. And it was one of the things that stopped me sponsoring people. You know, it was just really painful. But I had that experience where it showed me that I could show some empathy, you know, to be a human being to other human beings. And it just laid, a foundation in me that I did want to be here. I did want to stay clean in the NA Fellowship. And I used to call it being in recovery. I don't call it that anymore. Free thinkers meeting, so I guess I can say what I want. Second one was all about my dad. I was terrified that I was going to become my father. I was going to be that guy who was living by himself, who had no friends. Family didn't want to borrow him, and living somewhere the fuck far away somewhere. It was out of mind, out of sight, out of mind. And so I had to do something with that, and I was able to do that. And I'm not sure what I got from it because I'm still one of those guys who's fucking, you know, I struggle with the concept of bonding with my fellow human. And but I'm a lot better. And I'm a lot better since I found this secular community, because I found the fact that I don't have to be the big fish in the little pond. And I've been, especially lately, venturing out a lot more and socializing and interacting with the world without the fear of, am I going to bust just because I'm engaging with people who are drinking or who are passively, you know, whatever it is, smoking pot or whatever the fuck it is, whatever the environment is, you know. And I'm not saying that it's only recently happened. I haven't wanted to use drugs from fucking pretty much that first week, that first day, you know. Is that one of the other things, I guess, that I forgot to mention was I feel fortunate that consequential thinking was put in my path really, really quickly. And the consequences of the decisions I make, and maybe that was a thing that Martin kind of supported me on when we were sitting down in our many hundreds of conversations and step work and all that sort of stuff. But just the sheer fact that there is consequences to every decision I make. You know, and another sponsor said to me, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, so make a decision where you want to put yourself in the day, you know. So all that kind of stuff, you know. And that stuff still means something to me today. It really does. It's really important. And those key sort of phrase takeaways that I use, you know, I used to have a band on my wrist to remind me. I'd flick myself and I remember that stuff, you know. And I had to do that. I had to do it because, I don't know, I think drugs sufficiently fucked me, my brain up enough that I had to do it, you know. And I've been doing it for, as I said, for a long time now. That it's my setting, it's my default setting, that I don't go and kick my toe on the side of the door and go, I'm going to fucking jack up gear now, I'm going to run away. It's like I try and fucking live in the solution, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm perfect in everything that I do, quite the opposite. Again, the secular community has shown me that I can be incredibly flawed, incredibly inappropriate, but incredibly me. I'm allowed to be me. You know, and I'm accepted in this community, especially. And I'll say it, I am accepted a lot more in this secular community, that I, those meetings that I do and the people that I've met and engage with, than I've ever felt in mainstream Narcotics Anonymous. I feel there's a big disparity between the both. And whether that's right or wrong, it doesn't matter. That's just how I feel. So I feel more comfortable doing the meetings that I do on that secular meeting list. And so here I am 23 years later. I'm 56. I just turned 56. I had a heart attack 2.5 years ago. I had stents put in. I stopped smoking that day of my surgery. I've changed my life in regards to I look after myself physically a lot better now. I still don't smoke. So I'm not a non-smoker. I haven't smoked since. I just don't smoke. I've lost 14 kilos since this COVID shutdown. So I'm actually feeling quite okay about myself. And emotionally, I don't think I've ever been as comfortable in my skin as I have been in this recent past. And probably to do with a bit of ego around my body image. And I've spent the last couple of months in getting a lot of dental work done and stuff like that. But it is part of it, you know. It is part of it. It's part of the deal that I've got to feel good about who I am, you know, and what I look like. But I also understand that if I'm no good inside, if I don't feel okay about my insides, then whatever the fuck can be going on the outside, and it doesn't mean jack shit, you know. I'm very aware of that. And but I think just making that decision just to move away, not stop doing it, but just to be comfortable to say, you know what, I don't need NA to speak for me anymore. And it's probably been like that for over a year now. And I share about it when I do the meetings. I feel kind of good about it. You know, and I understand that sometimes when I used to go to meetings and I wouldn't see the old timers around as much anymore, and I wonder what happened to them. You know, it's like the old rock and rollers. And then I just realised that we do get lives. You know, Narcotics Anonymous, it's even in the literature, it actually says about getting back into the community sooner rather than later. So, you know, I'm quite completely comfortable with people living their life whatever the way they want to do it, believing in what they want to believe in, immersing themselves in a million meetings a week, all that sort of stuff, whatever floats the person's boat, that's cool. But it's not for this dude here, you know. That's just something that I made a decision that I just can't be that guy, because it's something about being a fraud. It's something about that statement that I used to make. I think I am, you know, think I'm just 30 days. I'm just 60 days. You know, I'd question the authenticity and fucking what I'm thinking and what I'm saying. You know, I'm saying things so I want people to believe it about me, but knowing that I'm going to do the complete opposite, you know. I had to find that truth within myself. And, I think I'm growing up to a degree, but I'm also still incredibly immature to a large degree, and I like that about myself. I understand why the fucking Rolling Stones are still playing music at 80-odd years of age, even though they've got a new drummer now, you know. I like the fact that I can be a 56-year-old single male with a 6-month-old Manx cat who's the father of two wonderful teenage daughters, and has a really healthy relationship with his ex-partner, has esteem in the community through interaction that I have with people in my community, has respect in his professional environment because I bring the principles that I've got from here, from you guys, and I bring them to my work environment, because I know that regardless of the title that I have, I need to be transparent for my own comfortability. You know what I mean? The consequences, the authenticity in my voice, in my actions and stuff like that. And it doesn't mean that I'm seeking to be a perfect human being. It just means that I just want to fucking feel comfortable about who I am. As me, you know, and because I've never put my name on the top of that list about making amends to. I really to a large degree, I still think very little about myself. You know, there's lots going on that's still incredibly flawed. But I make no apologies for that today, because the secular community allows me to be myself, and I'm really, really grateful. You know, there's people in the rooms that you know, Todd, in his conviction of the message, you know, and his drive, regardless of consequences. I really love that about that man, you know. And Elvis and Ronnie, you know, Marsha, I love hearing Marsha speak. I love hearing her voice and the way she IDs, you know, and watching her fall asleep at our Australian meetings and playing the Canadian national anthem to try and wake her up. That was a hoot. Yeah, so look, I'm searching and I'm reaching now. So I reckon I'm comfortable with what I've said. And I don't know if any of it's any good, and you'd probably delete the recording, but I'm glad that I got the opportunity to say some words. So I wish you all another 24, and thank you. Thank you, Marsha, for allowing me to do this. Thank you all. Cool.